not mistaken.
Okay.
Make a very clear case that snipers who fired at the protesters at Maidan in Kiev were hired by the opposition and were not. It wasn't President Yanukovych who fired at the protesters in Maidan. And what another major important thing to realize that people often do not have a good idea of is that Ukraine is a deeply divided country. It always has been and continues to be to this day. So it's not as if it's like one single entity, which we can say is Ukraine, where everyone has the same opinion and everyone would like to join the European Union. Because in the eastern part, the Russian-speaking area, who are citizens of the country, they've been living there for centuries, they see themselves more part of Russia. And they were historically more very supportive of the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
In West Ukraine, and in parts of central Ukraine, they have a very strong Ukrainian nationalist movement, and they are in favor of joining the European Union. And in some parts in Lviv, in far west Ukraine, right on the border with Poland, there was the independent state of Ukraine in 1941, whose leaders actively collaborated with the Nazis and carried out major massacres of Jews and Poles, of tens of thousands, and very severe acts of cruelty which took place. And these, by the way, and these leaders are currently being glorified by the current Ukrainian government. But I think I off-tracked a bit. So let's go to a little bit further back to where I began earlier, where things were standing this year. So there was the successful... There was a coup in Kiev in which the president was toppled.
Right.
After fascist gangs such as Right Sector, which were, and other fascist groups, such as Svoboda, whose leader met with U.S. State Department representatives such as Victoria Nuland. I'm talking about Ole Tiabuk.
Right.
So in any case, there was... toppling of the government, which was unconstitutional and illegal. And after that happened, shortly after, the people in East Ukraine and the Donbass, who were also likely to economically lose significantly if Ukraine were to join the EU, because then their industries would collapse and no one would buy their products, had basically said that they do not wish to be represented by the Kiev government. They don't see it as a government that represents them, especially since it included outraged fascists, and especially since one of the first step of the Ukrainian parliament was to outlaw the use of the Russian language in areas where more than 10, and as well as other languages, by the way, Czech, Romanian, and so on, of different minorities. And that's, by the way, another issue which people often do not understand, is that what actually took place in Maidan, the movement eventually, was a extreme nationalist movement, because you wouldn't expect, if the goal was civil society and having true democracy, you wouldn't expect the first step to be taken after they grabbed power in April, if I'm not mistaken, in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
Would be to outlaw languages other than Ukrainian.
Right.
So that's a very nationalist step, extremely nationalist step. And so where did things continue from there? So we have the whole story of Crimea, which I'll cover briefly. Basically, what happened was that there already are about 25,000 Russian soldiers in Crimea, which are there as part of internationally acceptable agreements between Ukraine and Russia. And the people of Crimea have historically, for three centuries, been part of Russia. And then the region was given over to the Ukraine by the Soviet Prime Minister Khrushchev in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
In the mid-1960s. And in any case, there was a referendum which took place in the area, which was supervised by different representatives, but was not recognized by most Western countries, although there were representatives of different Western countries there. And at the referendum, a majority supported succeeding, separating and joining Russia in Crimea.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, polls after that in groups confirmed that the majority supports this move and is very pleased with it. So it's not as if it was just a fake referendum, because various polls conducted come up with the same result, that the people that was the wish of the people there. But this situation in Crimea took place as a result of the unconstitutional coup in Kiev, and in which many people were killed, which was entirely supported by the West, by the European Union, by the United States, by Canada. So basically, the coup in Kiev created a chain reaction. So the first reaction was a referendum in Crimea, and then the second reaction was that the people of Donbass, which is in East Ukraine, it's working class, mostly industrial area, they decided that they do not feel represented by the not only do they not feel represented, actually, but they were quite fearful of the new government, because the new government expressed very hostile views towards ethnic Russians and Russian speakers. And therefore, they declared their independence. They declared the Donetsk People's Republic and the Lugansk People's Republic. And immediately after that happened, the Ukrainian government sent tanks and heavy equipment to the area, and they started firing on the residents there. And then the referendum, which took place, the majority of the people did vote for their independent republics in Donetsk and Lugansk. And soldiers who were sent by Kiev to the area actually fired at people directly who were trying to express their right to vote in this referendum. And there are videos of the events of two people from the National Guard, of the Ukrainian National Guard, firing on voters. So basically, what we have is a very interesting situation, which supposedly the question here is Ukrainian democracy. So we have a coup in Kiev, which was not democratic, which was carried out by violent actions, even though many protesters had legitimate concerns or expressing their opinion, but it was carried out by violent actions of a fascist group. And then, that is considered like legitimate and democratic. But when you have a referendum in Crimea or a referendum in Donbass where the people actually voted and did not voted in a systemic way and expressed their opinion very clearly that they do not feel represented by the new Kiev regime, then that has been that hasn't been accepted as legitimate by the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is what's going on. Just that's the overview of like the situation. So going forward from that, I just wanted to ask you, like, what is the Donetsk People's Republic? How is it organized? And you already mentioned some of this, but how did it really come about?
Okay, good question. So the referendum was, first it was a referendum, then there were elections,
mm-hmm.
and then Alexander Soroshenko, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, became the prime minister. I actually got to meet the foreign minister, Alexander Kaufman. And basically, they've been having to defend themselves from the very beginning. So basically, I visited Donetsk, and I saw what is going on there. The majority of the people, almost everyone I saw, supports the republic, but they've been in charge of basically, first of all, supplying for the citizens, because the whole area is under humanitarian blockade by Kiev, so nothing can come through from Kiev to Donetsk, and the banks have been closed down. And if I'm not mistaken, the Donetsk People's Republic recently nationalized one of the banks in the area. But the banks have been closed down, so they do not operate. And therefore, they have different currencies that are being used. So basically, they've been struggling just to defend their territory first and foremost. And that has been the main concern for now, because people are there coming under constant bombardment, even despite the ceasefire. And from what I saw, life goes on as normal to the degree possible. Like, there's a theater plays every day in the afternoon. There's a curfew in the evening. But the government is now providing pensions to the elderly and health services, the government of the Donetsk People's Republic, because the Ukrainian government cut off pensions to all people in the area, and as well as health services. So basically what we have is, because the people of Donetsk declared their own independent republic, the Kiev government has basically inflicting collective punishment on them, pretty much in reminding in many ways what Israel, the different actions Israel has been carrying out against the Palestinians and imposing
right.
a collective punishment, and also in demonizing the entire population, because we have like President Poroshenko saying, Ukrainian President Poroshenko saying, like, their children, like the children of people of Donbass, will be held in basements until like they'll submit to us, basically. And this kind of talk of a president of a country against his own civilians, and not only civilians of his own country but children, is also reminds me pretty much of what Israeli leaders have been saying about Gaza, that Gaza will not be peaceful, the people of Gaza will not enjoy a peaceful sleep until they stop firing rockets at Israel, for example. But in any case, the situation there is very difficult, because there's a strong case to indicate that more attacks and the area will continue, and there'll be a new onslaught. Right now, things are fairly peaceful, even though there's continued bombardment of some areas near the airport, but there's a danger that things will escalate again if the U.S. pushes for it. So I would say, as far as the People's Republic, I wouldn't say that... I would say they're basically focused mostly on trying to maintain a normal living, return to normalcy to the degree possible. The universities still function, and to provide different services, as I said, medical services, pensions, and so on. But the problem is that their status of where things are going still remains unclear,
mm-hmm.
because it is not as if the people that want to join Russia, the majority say that they would agree to remain in Ukraine as long as the current regime will be replaced, the war criminals will be brought to justice,
mm-hmm.
and their rights will be fully respected, their cultural rights and political rights, well, cultural rights first and foremost, and these things are unlikely to happen. So right now they're in a war situation. They're unlikely to happen anytime soon, so they're in a war situation at the moment. And they're trying to protect what they have, and they're keen in resisting Kiev's attempt to subjugate them and take over, especially since I think they know pretty well that if the Ukrainian army succeeds to break in, which right now I don't think will happen, then this would end up in major bloodshed, because the Ukrainian army already has been committing various war crimes throughout the region, like killing civilians, bombing civilians, targeting chemical plants, hospitals. I saw a hospital that was hit, as well as residential areas, and so on. So that's the situation now.
Yeah, so the situation is very serious, like right now, you know,
yes.
with this kind of stuff. And so from my understanding, like, there have been two kind of periods of conflict and two ceasefires so far, right? And so, like, we're just kind of in this kind of in-between stage where it looks like things are going to flare up again at any time.
Exactly. Because now, there is officially a ceasefire, and in general, I would say there's not like a major war going on. But while I was there, we heard bombshells in our area right next to us was bombed. So the people, mm-hmm. there is still like a small-scale fighting taking place between the self-defense forces of the Donetsk People's Republic and the Ukrainian army and other irregular Ukrainian militias which are in the area.
Mm-hmm.
But the big question is, to what degree, as you said, will this ceasefire hold on? There are many forces which suggest that it won at some point, if Washington pushes for it, or if there'll be an attempt. But especially my biggest concern is that as the economic situation in Ukraine deteriorates, and as the government may even be forced to default, the easiest solution for the regime would be to begin a larger war once again to evade criticism and deflect attention from the other problems and
yeah.
to try to forget about the economic issue.
Yeah, so try to really, really kind of play that kind of nationalist sort of rhetoric and kind of like, you know, direct the people away from their problems, this kind of thing, you know, classic reactionary
exactly.
tactics.
Exactly.
So I was going to ask you about the whole concept of Novorossiya and, like, you know, like, what is the Donetsk People's Republic relation with Luhansk, and, you know, what's the framework there? You know, how does that operate? Like, how do these republics work together?
Okay, that's a good question. I'm not sure I would know that. I'll try to tell you what I know.
Okay, yeah.
First of all, I would imagine there's a lot of collaboration between the two governments. I would imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And some people I talk to, that situation. Secondly, there's are many... but I would say there are some differences. Like, whereas... I would say it seems my impression was that in Donetsk, the people that really have it more organized and more in control, while in Lugansk, a major commander, a communist commander, whose name was Mazdovoy, was just assassinated a few weeks ago, and they're still not certain who it was. So that's
right.
A major source of concern. So in Lugansk, well, my impression was that whereas in Donetsk, people are very, the leaders are very committed to socialist ideals, or at least to, are very, to put it bluntly, like have their act together. And Lugansk, you have many fighters who are, and the people are, but I'm not sure if everyone in the government is as clean as
right.
People in Donetsk.
Yeah, because just what I've been hearing is pretty much like the Luhansk government, there's more like kind of, I guess, Putinists, if you want to call them that, like, you know, people who kind of were more along the line of the Russian government, right? They just kind of like, you know, follow the same line that they do. And they're not as like kind of autonomous or, you know, committed to a different path, like certainly different economic principles or socialist kind of ideals or any of this sort of stuff. You know, there's kind of like this divide.
Well, I don't, from what I can only say what I know. What I, the best I know is that the Prime Minister of Lugansk, and there are people in Lugansk in various positions,
mm-hmm.
in government positions, not the public, because the public went out en masse to the funeral of Mazdovoy, who called for a major, like, he was a strong communist. But
yeah.
I don't know if they're Putinists. I would say, like, they do represent the people of the region. I mean, they were elected, so they're there, but they're not, I'm not sure how clean they are, like, in all their affairs financially.
Okay, yeah.
Bluntly.
Yeah, so there could be, like, questions of corruption and this
exactly,
kind of stuff.
Exactly.
So,
however, they're still obviously better off than, like, the the fascist groups, but
oh, yeah.
There's definitely issues about corruption.
Yeah. So I want to ask you about, I mean, I don't know how much you know about, like, these kind of, like, the forms of economic organization in Donetsk. You know, we mentioned before, like, a bank had been nationalized. Did you see any other examples of, like, nationalization or, like, you say, like, socialism being put into practice there or any of this sort of thing?
Yes, it's a good question. Well, the government provides for pensions, healthcare, and tries to keep, and obviously protection, and trying to keep an orderly life, like cleaning the streets, catering for the elderly, providing food for the elderly who are stuck in neighborhoods which are being constantly bombarded, and so, and in such areas. As far as, I would have liked to see more, like, outright nationalizing of different industries and so on. I haven't explored that issue in depth, and there have been some things taking place, but not at a very large scale from what I can tell.
Okay.
And my impression is that it could be possible through several reasons. Either it's because the war has been going on, and that's been the major source of concern now.
Right.
Or they've been under pressure by other forces, maybe in Moscow, maybe a local oligarch. Although, like, the local oligarch of the area fled, but maybe by other interest groups, not to go on in this with this agenda.
Yeah, because I was just thinking, like, that obviously being at war is probably a major factor here. Like, and you know, if they think, like, if they do push in this direction, it's going to destabilize. You know, they're going to destabilize themselves. Like, certain people are going to, you know, turn against them. This kind of thing at a time when things are pretty desperate. I guess that could be, like, part of their calculation, right?
Yes, that may be, or they may be concerned that the economy will collapse very quickly
right.
if that happens overnight. Generally, I think my impression was that they do have, actually, Roger Annis, who runs the New Cold War blog, he's a Canadian who also visited, he's been writing a bit more about the socialist plans. There are more plans for the future, but now there's, it doesn't seem like there haven't been fully being carried out. Also,
yeah.
there's a very large a very realistic scenario with people that we're discussing, which was that if the Donbass would be attacked again in a very like significant way, then the forces of the area will be forced to will go on the offensive and liberate other villages which are currently under Ukrainian control.
Right.
But if I would dare to venture my guess, I would say that I would say that two things. First of all, the majority of the fighters that I saw and I also saw fresh graves in the area are people from the region. Many people from the region are fighting. It's not as if like Russian soldiers were sent there.
Because that's the propaganda, right?
Exactly. Yeah. But right. At the same time, no doubt there are plenty of Russian soldiers in the area who volunteer to fight.
Right.
And also, there are many like strong indications that Russia has been supplying them with arms to protect themselves. So I would say there is a possibility that that these arms have been given. For example, there was a commander before Igor Sukho who had like greater ambitions to take on to take his force all the way and try to go and take over Kiev, and then he was removed, and that was, if I'm not mistaken, according to many suggestions, indicators, he was removed, and a more like pragmatic person was put in place as a precondition for the Donbass receiving military aid.
Right.
So that's the thing. My impression is that. They're under pressure at this point to keep things based on the status quo. And I think, and the reason that is because, I mean, the reason that is as far as like offensive, military offensive is concerned, is because there's a big concern that if they go too much on the offensive and this could escalate much further. So Russia's been trying to prevent this from becoming a much wider war. But at the same time, it hasn't been abandoning the people of the area. So they're playing this balancing act. But but it's very possible, as you said, that there's pressure on the Donetsk People's Republic and in Austin Lugansk by certain forces, I don't know who, but not to carry out socialist plans at this point anyway.
Okay, so maybe you could discuss like the whole... I've heard quite a few things about international volunteers coming to the Donbass, volunteering for the to serve with these the various militias that are protecting the people there. So I don't know if you encountered any of these people or if you talked to them, but I mean maybe you could kind of give your impressions of these people.
I talked to a few people, and basically there's. A very large, from what I understand, there's a very like large representation from Spain.
Right.
Many fighters came from Spain in light of a historical precedent of the 1936 civil war in Spain, the anti-fascist war. And there are some fighters also from France, from Brazil, even apparently like some from Germany. So there are a significant number of international volunteers who came to basically fight the fascists, just as George Orwell, for example, writes in his book about Catalonia and the war in Catalonia. But I don't know what their exact numbers are. I recently saw that like about 30 Spaniards left for the Donbass like about a month and a half ago. But there's definitely like a large number of internationals, also a few Americans also who came to help.
Oh yeah.
And I would say that truly helps the people of the region to feel more empowered because from their perspective, and rightly so, I think it's fair to argue, they've been entirely abandoned by the international community. The fact they're being bombarded and many Western countries seem to take no issue with the fact that civilians are being killed and bombarded. So far, over 6,000 people at least have been killed. And even inside Ukraine, there's been many repressive actions taken. Many people have been kidnapped, tortured. There are many testimonies of torture. So the situation is very, very bad. So the fact that international volunteers came has been very inspiring to locals.
Well, yeah, these people coming to were willing to put their lives at risk, you know, like for this cause, like the cause of these people. You know, that's very impressive.
Exactly, especially since many of them realize now that they probably won't be able to go back to their country ever, possibly.
Well, yeah, because I think I heard that some of the Spanish volunteers, like, tried to go back to Spain and they got arrested, you know, like, exactly. as soon as they crossed the border, basically, and now they're, like, on charges of, like, terrorism or something.
Exactly.
Yes, I heard that. Yeah. Like, that's pretty disheartening to hear. But you kind of mentioned a few of these things, but I think it's definitely important to talk about the crimes of the various fascist groups, like, not only, like, in say, the Donetsk region, but, like, in Ukraine in general, just so we understand, like, what it is that these people are really up against.
Yes. Well, I was there. I saw with my own eyes the situation there. Mm-hmm. I mean, I saw elderly people living in neighborhoods. Some of them have no family, so no one there to take care of them, although they receive food and medical support by the local republic.
Yep.
And they face constant daily bombardment. I saw, like, grad shells inside civilian buildings inside the city. And even when we were there, we were shelled. So the Ukrainian army has intentionally been targeting residential neighborhoods and doing so with impunity. I mean, it's quite remarkable that you have Ukrainian forces who are targeting civilians, and the U.S. and the EU take no issue with that. Many war crimes have been committed. Like, there's been, first of all, civilians have been shot to death at gunpoint in different territories occupied by the Ukrainian forces, by the Ukrainian army.
Mm-hmm.
And citizens have also been kidnapped at checkpoints run by the Ukrainian army and then tortured severely. And then they were very severely borrowing both techniques used by the CIA in Guantanamo and techniques used by the Bandera fascist gangs in during World War II. And then they're usually exchanged with for Ukrainian soldiers who were captured by the Donetsk People's Republic.
Mm-hmm.
But there's probably, like, no one knows for certain, but there are hundreds of people who are currently in Ukrainian prisons being tortured, and no one knows their whereabouts. No one knows what is the latest or how they are.
Yeah.
And in addition to that, like, journalists have been killed, like, communist leaders have been killed. The Communist Party is outlawed in Ukraine.
I believe your trade unions also have been repressed, right?
Yes. And they're doing that because they embarked on a very strong austerity program.
Like privatization, like, across the board, right?
Exactly. And that's why the economic situation there is just going to deteriorate.
Mm.
Because that's been also the precondition for the loans that they've been receiving for the IMF, is that they've taken very strong austerity programs. And the quality of life is expected to deteriorate very rapidly, and it already is. And that's why, of course, we'll be seeing, like, probably more and more militaristic actions taken. And also that's why the government has been engaged in, like, ultra-nationalist propaganda.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's very interesting. I mean, it's not just Ukraine. Ukraine is maybe the most extreme example of this. But even if you look at Poland, if you look at other countries in Eastern Europe that are really kind of, you know, engaged in mass privatization and all this sort of stuff, they use the most vitriolic nationalist rhetoric imaginable, right? And try to direct all the people's attention against various minority groups, you know, say that they're the problem. They need to be destroyed. They need to be repressed. You know, like, you know, Poland for the Poles, Ukrainian for Ukrainians, all this sort of stuff. And, you know, really it's just a cover for privatization. You know, fascism is a cover for privatization.
100%.
Yeah.
100%. Like, you make an excellent point. And I'll just make 2 points I have on this issue, because I think that's an excellent, very important point. The first is that, like, I think Ukraine is a classical case to anyone who studies it, like, in depth, for the fact that fascism and capitalism goes very well together.
Yep.
And in fact, actually a Greek filmmaker just produced a film called Fascism INC, in which he covers that relationship between fascism and capitalism. And he obviously claims that fascism is an advanced stage of capitalism. But that Ukraine is a a very good example for a situation in which the government embarks on war and fascism because it's an economic crisis.
Yep.
And in a way, if you look at the broad picture in Europe, there's two countries where capitalism failed very clearly. The first one is Ukraine, the other one is Greece.
Yeah.
So while in Ukraine, the government has been pursuing war and fascism in order to have people deflect their attention from the economic crisis. In Greece, the government has been trying to negotiate it, but they're under incredible pressure, and it's unclear at this point whether they will surrender or not to the dictates of the European Union, to the neoliberal dictates.
Yeah.
But these are two places where capitalism, neoliberal capitalism, failed very clearly. Obviously, Spain too, but in Greece, it's even worse.
Mm-hmm.
But very few make the connection between, like, the fact that this is a crisis of capitalism and that and the connection between these two regions, and also the connection between fascism and militarism and capitalism. Because if you look, the first time that actually even the word privatization, as it was in German, came from during the Nazi regime. That's when, like, the government carried out, like, privatizations.
Yeah, it's true.
And very few people are aware of that, actually. So it's the thing is, it becomes very clear in the case of Ukraine and also in the case of Nazi Germany that you can have many, you can practice a very different, like, take capitalism to a very extreme stage when you have fascism on your side. And that's actually also the concern, like, globally, that we're moving more and more to a situation, because capitalism seems to be in a structural crisis,
mm-hmm.
coming to its end, like, in the coming decades, as, like, Emmanuel Wallerstein, for example, argues, that basically there's we're in a situation in which we'll be moving either to feudalism and fascism, and we see it more and more in, like, the repression of civil liberties and the cracking and the police repression by the police in different Western countries, or to, like, a more socialist, a more humane alternative.
Like, yeah, basically towards, like, a more like, even more revolutionary situation, at least in some places, you know. So
exactly.
It's like this is like the alternative basically would be is between socialism and barbarism, you know.
Exactly.
It's almost becoming that. I think it was Rosa Luxemburg who said that originally, but yeah, like, it's pretty, this is, like, the reason why I don't think people should ignore what's going on in Ukraine, right? Because, I mean, this is, like, this situation is, like, emerging in many, many places now, like, just around the world, and you have to understand it, like, if you actually want to, if you want to effectively, like, fight for, like, that better future that we've been, you know, like, that socialism, right? Like, you really have to understand this stuff.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you look at the global events and understand them more thoroughly, you analyze them more thoroughly, because the mainstream media has been wholly misrepresenting entire regions, it becomes very clear. And I actually spoke to a Greek volunteer who went to visit the region, the Donbass, just a few weeks ago. And he told me, look, we're trying to basically, he came to visit, but he's been very active politically in Greece, raising awareness on the issue. And what he's saying is that we're trying to defeat, like, fascism and NATO in Ukraine, so that they,
yeah.
Because if they succeed in Ukraine, they'll do it in other places too. And that's, and I think we'll see more and more, that my concern is that we're going to see more and more, like, fascist, we'll be seeing more and more fascist parties rise in different countries as the economy declines, or people choosing socialism in different countries.
Yeah. Because obviously you're going to get resistance to fascism as well, right? And that's what also needs to be mentioned, you know? It's not like this kind of stuff happens without a fight, you know?
Very true.
Yeah.
Very true.
And I guess Donetsk is proof of that.
Very true. As well as many Ukrainians in Kiev and other places who have been protesting against, protesting against the U.S. involvement. And those who spoke out against the war crimes have been arrested or killed, but many of them. But definitely people have been resisting. But I think in light of history, when we have a government which praises fascist groups and practices outright fascism, and there are many indications for that, if you look at all the characters
of
fascism, then that people, like, today are oblivious to that is very disturbing, because fascism doesn't stop at a given point. It obviously seeks to expand.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I believe the right sector now has a presence in Toronto, actually, amongst the Ukrainian community.
That's horrible.
Which is quite a disturbing thing. Golden Dawn does as well. You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was, unfortunately, Joshua Tartakovsky, who we were interviewing there about the situation in Ukraine, fortunately got cut off, so we weren't able to quite finish the interview. But nonetheless, I do appreciate him coming on Back in the USSR. I'm going to try to have him back on at some point in the future. And we more or less that was actually quite lucky. His phone ran out of credit just as the interview was about to end. So I think that was about the best timing we could have hoped for when it comes to something like that happening. So overall, I'm happy with it. So thank you for listening to Back in the USSR, and please stay tuned.
Yeah, this track deals with the troubles arising in Eastern Europe, which could very soon spread over to here if you're not careful. Got base instincts in check. It's cool.
The demons rising again at this time of great crisis. No surprise that it's rising into crisis. Encouraged by betrayals of so-called socialists. Encouraged from the coffers of big business. The black shirts march again in German towns. Handing out beatdowns, murdering blacks and browns. And even whites they consider inferior. Consider themselves superior. Hitler resurrected. The male disrespected. Printing a diary, giving a pepper to a Nazi. These are dangerous times, so please wake up and understand what's up with the countries of Europe and in France. The NF gets votes and cuts throats in the port of Marseille. Is the fascist mainstay and nationalism feeds the fires of hate. We need to demonstrate and physically decimate this racist anti-communist crew. Kill one or two and beat the rest of them blue. Or should I say red, cause there's no quarter given or asked for, cause that's how we're living. And so I gotta ask you this then, is it just evil or to do with the system that creates nation states and racial hate, decides our fates and then devastates like the destruction it caused in World War II? Now in 92, are we going back to the day of the jackboot, or will we change forever? I don't know about you, but I go hell for leather. Beat the fascists down like they go beat a Waterloo. They're as strong as we're weak. True indeed, true indeed, true.
Well, we got troubles coming from the east side. Troubles from the east side. We got troubles coming from the east side. Yeah, trouble again.
And the world is getting nervous. Oh, mankind, you better be conscious. Yeah.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, and that was the interview which I did earlier this year in June of this year with Joshua Tartakovsky, who of course had just recently been in Donetsk in East Ukraine, and witnessed the struggle against fascism in Ukraine firsthand, and the struggle against imperialism in Ukraine, because of course fascism really virtually always is in support of empire. You know, once again. And we talked about this when Brendan Campisi was here last week. You know, we talked about how, fascist groups make use of terror, you know, and it serves their interest to have people intimidated, you know, and living in fear. You know, it serves their interest. So they will cause wanton destruction, you know, and certainly that's what fascist forces have been doing in East Ukraine. And usually that is done in the service of empire, of imperial interests, of course, of breaking people down. So the empire can exploit them and use them, you know, extract profit from them, you know, and multinational corporations can go in and whatnot. And of course, in Ukraine, you know, I'm sure the same thing exists in Syria. You know, Ukraine has considerable natural resources that the global capitalist order wants to exploit, you know, and in historically it has not had the access that it desired. And of course now it wants a total free-for-all. It wants, you know, free access, no barriers to entry whatsoever, you know, to exploit the agricultural land, to exploit, you know, mines, natural resources, and you know, and the labor of the Ukrainian people and what have you. You know, it wants total access and wants total control, and the same thing is what it wants ultimately in Syria as well. You know, full access to oil and natural resources in Syria, and like the labor of the people, and even the water, and all these kind of resources that that the capitalist system wants to make a profit off of. And you know, it is willing to use the most horrific violence imaginable to secure that, to break the will of the people to resist. And that is where death squads and fascist gangs and, you know, and Contras and terrorist groups and this sort of thing come in handy, because they do those things. And of course, so the CIA and different imperial organizations make use of those kind of groups and visit violence upon the people and cause wanton destruction. And really, that's what the people are fighting against in Syria and what they're fighting against in Ukraine and what they're fighting against in other places around the world. You know, so that has to be recognized. So one of the things I really want to close out the show with is, once again, Michael Parenti's amazing descriptions of what imperialism is and what it has done around the world, and because whose interests it serves. You know, because, of course, so many of the what we face in the world today, whether that's racism or sexism or homophobia or what have you, or terrorism, all these things really come out of imperialism. Really, the imperialism that began, that saw European powers basically carve the world up, you know, really starting in 1492 with Columbus, and the kind of distortions and devastation that led to in human affairs. And the legacy of that is still very much with us in the world today, and it has to be understood. So that's why I'm going to close out the show with that. So I'm going to see you all here next week, brothers and sisters. Until then, be well and solidarity. And please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Now then you got about 5 centuries of imperialism coming along. And imperialism was when the powers of Western Europe began to expropriate the land, labor, and wealth of Eastern Europe. That was the first area of expansion and exploitation that they went into. And the second was the New World. And then, having developed all the superior firepower and mobility and transportation, they went then into Africa and Asia and further into Latin America. And with this imperialism, which is a history that really, to read the history of modern imperialism, as it's still going on today, to read that history is really to read a history of a succession of the most horrendous, horrible atrocities that one can imagine. Now, when the ruling classes of these imperialist nations plundered and exploited the land, the labor, the natural resources, and the markets of other people, when they enslaved their labor, when they burned their villages, when they destroyed their industries and their crafts and their mines and their herds and their crops, when they raped them and murdered them and mutilated them, when they did all that sort of thing, and they worked them to death in the latifundios and the plantations and in the mines, then theories had to come along to justify what you were doing. And the theories about these lesser races proliferated. These lesser races were animals. They were cruel savages. They were incapable of self-governance. They were like pathetic, helpless children. They'd been around living in peace for, you know, 5,000 years before you came along, but suddenly now they wouldn't be able to get along without us. They were devoid of the normal sensibilities that one might expect from a person in civilized societies. Again, not an anachronistic attitude. In my own lifetime, the lifetime of most of you, the adult lifetime of most of you, General Westmoreland, you remember him? Vietnam, your average Asian. The Asian doesn't place the same importance on life we Americans do. That's your average Asian. And with the massive bombings and saturation bombings, a war of horror and attrition and mass slaughter, he was pointing out that indeed one of those two protagonists did not place the same value on life as the other, but he had it mixed up, that's all. And with imperialism, there came in the 19th century the class-based, racist, patriarchal theories about human nature, known as science. Science came along and rushed in there with measurements of skulls and brain sizes. Whites were superior to blacks, males were superior to women, men of substance were superior to men of poverty. Race, gender, and class again. 19th century science gave us a great scientist, by the way, who took human beings out of the medieval metaphysical scheme of things and made them part of the natural order of things. And in a sense, it was a very revolutionary and very progressive thing that he did. A very great contribution, Charles Darwin. But a closer reading of some of the other things Darwin said in his Descent of Man, for instance, definitely shows him to be a product of 19th century science, which in turn is a product of 19th century imperialism and capitalism and upper-class white male Europeans. Darwin, quote, "Man is more courageous, pugnacious, and energetic than woman, and has a more inventive genius." This is the best scientific mind of the 19th century in England, British Royal Society. "Men are superior in every activity requiring deep thought, reason, or imagination." Except imagination about women, I guess. "Men vastly excel in the sciences, philosophy, history, the arts, poetry, painting, and sculpture." Ready? Sisters, are you ready? Women excel in tenderness, unselfishness, intuition, imitation, and other qualities that are characteristic of the lesser races. Darwin argued, in effect, that women are less evolved biologically, evolutionarily. For Darwin, culture doesn't explain anything. By the way, it's true of most of these people. Cultural differences are the thing that needs to be explained. And these differences are explained as being grounded in biological development in human natures in the process of natural selection. In the Descent of Man, or natural selection, or both, a combination of both, biological, innate biological structures and natural selection and development of those biological developments in natural selection. Let's turn to what Darwin had to say about races. Now, we're talking right 1880. This is when England is building an empire upon which the sun never sets. At the time Darwin is saying this, the Brits are killing a variety of people from Ceylon to India to Malaysia to God knows where, Africa, or working them to death. Darwin thought that the sense of smell was more highly developed in darker races, as in animals, than in white civilized peoples. The same, by the way, with other physiological characteristics. The rudimentary ear lobule, the larger wisdom teeth, the more pronounced conical form of the canine teeth, and certain bone structures, all supposedly common to the darker races, and all, therefore, more proximate to animal physiology, testify to their less advanced evolutionary development. By the way, none of that's true. In case you want to go checking teeth. Here's Darwin talking. "Given, quote, the hideous ornaments and the equally hideous music admired by most savages," unquote, Darwin concluded that their aesthetic faculty was less developed than that of birds. I mean, what impresses you is the total oblivion, the total ignorance of the brutalities of imperialism, the total ignorance of the adverse effects on the health and survival of native peoples that imperialism had when they came into exposure to European diseases, the deracination, the mistreatment, the deaths. Darwin looks at this, he discusses some particular tribe that dies out. I think it was a tribe in the American Southwest. Says they died out. He concluded that the extinction of these tribes when they came in contact with whites was evidence of their lesser biological capacity, their immunity systems, their capacities, and such. Nothing having to do with starvation, nothing having to do with injecting smallpox into blankets and then selling them to the Indians, nothing having to do with the Gatling gun and the Maxim gun and mass murder. They die out because they're lesser. Savages snarled more often and had less control of their fear reactions and sphincter muscles than did Europeans, Darwin said. Now, how did he suppose he found that out? And what did he do to study that one? I don't know. It's not the kind of research I'd want to do. "Thus, they were more like monkeys and dogs in that respect." That's from The Descent of Man. "Civilized males were less emotive than savages and less inclined to weep." Now, even among civilized males, there were ethnic and evolutionary differences, by the way. Englishmen rarely cried or shrugged their shoulders energetically, while Frenchmen and Italians were given to such less advanced displays. Why the absence of shrugging of shoulders is seen as an evolutionary gain is not clear to me. I don't understand. You see, but you're getting this very interesting convolution. You're getting you're getting the trait of what is assumed to be the more evolved person as evidence of that evolution. So on the one hand, right, that Englishman manifests these traits, therefore these traits must be the more evolved traits. He has these more evolved traits, therefore he is more evolved. And the thing just kind of self-fulfills itself. Darwin, by the way, is rather ignorant of the so-called lesser peoples. I mean, if you ever want to, he mentioned the Italians, if you ever wanted to see a people, southern Italian peasants, who I'm sure he would feel very uncomfortable being in the same room with, if you ever wanted to see a people, having come from that stock myself, all my grandparents, both sides, if you want to see a people who had a rigorous idea of social strictures and interpersonal diplomacy and what was proper and what was hospitality and what you said and what you didn't say and how you presented this and didn't present that. Or if you go to any savage society, so-called savage, or primitive peoples, native peoples, indigenous peoples, anywhere, whether it be American Indians or Melanesians, again, the same thing. Elaborate codes, certainly as elaborate, as advanced, as subtle, as nuanced, as anything you could find in upper-class English society. Maybe not quite as stuffy, but certainly they were there. The fact that he was ignorant of them, the fact that he never saw or talked to one of these people, except to glance at them from the side of his boat, doesn't mean that it didn't exist, you see. And by the way, there was a very interesting thing that happened in the British Royal Society, where a debate broke out between Darwin and his closest collaborator, Wallace, where Wallace got up and suddenly started making very strange statements, because they had a problem. The problem was, if the human brain is a manifestation of the level of evolution, why is the savage brain not vastly small? Why is it roughly the same or so large as the white British European brain? They had these gradations. Thomas Huxley was another one who believed it. He said the most highly evolved are the Europeans. The most highly evolved of the Europeans are the upper class. The most highly evolved of them are the upper class Englishmen. The most highly evolved of them are the members of our British Royal Society. Me. Why could the world be more like me, right? Huxley, with all the characteristic modesty of his class, decided it had that hierarchy. That was Darwin's hierarchy, too. But they had this problem. If these savages had such good brains, why weren't they more evolved? And Wallace got up and he says, you know, I don't think this is a problem, because I think they are evolved. And the thing about Wallace is he had lived in Melanesia for about 2 years. He says, I've lived with these people, and I find among them people who have a range of intelligence and subtlety and imagination and gift and craft and science within the confines of their material culture and all, which the best among them could compare favorably with members of our British Royal Society. And there was a gasp, of course. That was like saying, down with the Queen or something. And that was the difference between Wallace and, on one hand, and Huxley and Darwin on the other.
It's the paradigm of the wagon train versus the swarthy hordes, first enunciated very well by in a marvelous article by Tom Engelhardt in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. It could be happening in the American Wild West. It could be in the Amazon jungle, the North African desert, the Sudan, the Transvaal, the South Pacific jungles, or Indochina. The scene is generally the same. There's a fort, or an encampment, or a wagon train. And inside that encampment are the human beings. They're white. They're human. They're warm, they're attractive, they talk, and they're nice. Outside come the swarthy hordes, the savages. They can be Indians, they can be Bushmen, they can be Arabs on camels and horses or whatever else. And they are the subhumans, and they are attacking the human beings. And the wagons form their circle. And the human beings know what to do. They level their guns and they begin to knock off, shoot, and kill these screaming savages who attack them. Why do the swarthy hordes attack the white people? You don't know. They never tell you. Is it to protect their lands? Is it to protect their herds? Is it to protect their villages and their towns and their families and their children? No, it's just because they like to do that. That's their thing. They like to attack. And so they have to be killed. And by the way, it's not even bravery that they manifest, as they charge in great numbers and get cut down in horrible numbers. This is not even bravery, although similar acts by whites would be portrayed as heroic. This itself is portrayed as a manifestation of the Swazi hordes, their fanatic, crazed way of wanting to bloodlust. Now the trouble with this paradigm is that it turns the history of the last 400 years on its head. That it reverses the roles of usurper and usurped. It reverses the roles of victim and victimizer. It reverses the roles of those who were massacred and those who were doing the massacring. It was the European and North American civilizers, so-called, who went in there and destroyed the villages and destroyed their industries and destroyed their townships. Read Engels on North Africa, what happened to the Arabs and Berbers, and when he goes in and describes the beautiful towns with the fine, hard stone and plaster buildings and their woolen industries and their mining industries and their arts and crafts and all that, and then read the description of the French troops coming in and systematically destroying it and killing every man, woman, and child. Read about how the Germans went into South Africa and killed the Herero tribe. 80,000 people, they killed 60,000 of them, and the other 20,000 they used that slave labor in their minds. Read Mark Twain's angry, raging comments about King Leopold of Belgium, calling him a mad dog and what he did to the innocent, unoffending people of the Congo, taking them and enslaving them, 1 million of them a year dying in the mines in the Congo. That's what the history's about. That's what John Wayne is about. And what these films do is they reverse that history, stand it on its head. They do what Joseph Goebbels said. They give you a big lie, and they embellish it, and they make you root for the guys in the wagon train.
Now, in this age of democracy, where everyone is saying they're for democracy, we also hear this litany of capitalism and class ideology. You know, I happened to find myself in a hotel in Antigua once. It was an overnight. It was the most horrible experience I had. The travel agent said, it's okay, go there, it's informal. I said, well, it's kind of expensive for a little informal hotel. I got there, and it was inhabited by rich American, British, and Canadian people. And I had dinner sitting at a table with these people, and it was rather fascinating because everybody sitting was white and rich. The women were talking about where they bought their gold. So we go to South Africa to buy our gold, saying things like that. It was really great. This was back in 1978, 9, and the men were talking about investment opportunities and this place or that place and all that. And all of them were sitting, and they were white. And they got onto one of their favorite subjects, which white, rich, exploited people talk about, which is how lazy the poorer people are, you know. And I noticed everyone who was standing was black. The ones who were cooking the food, bringing the food, serving the food, and they were all black. Those were lazy ones were black. And there were some people at those tables that never worked a day in their lives who were making statements. Well, you can imagine me choking on my food. But it's really interesting, the capacity for selective perception about what human beings are, the ability to have your class ideology serve and predefine your reality. I saw a documentary film once on Nicaragua, and there was an interview, a pre-revolutionary, before the Sandinista revolution, an interview of a group of very well-to-do Nicaraguan men and women sitting on a veranda, dressed to the nines, with their drinks, and the men of their haunches and their dark glasses and all that, and the women were there with all the layers of jewelry and everything else, and the coiffured hair, and they're all sitting there. I mean, on their backs, they had enough to feed a whole Nicaraguan village for the better part of a year, I would wager. And they're sitting there, and they were doing that favorite sport when the rich get together, talking about what is so wrong with the poor. Why can't they just not be the way they are? They're just something. And then finally, one of them hadn't done any talking. This guy says, what the poor need is education. I said, hey, the liberal, here he comes. Thank God, there's one saying that. And I perk up a little, you know. The snarl begins to leave my face, and I get kind of my little hopeful Oliver Twist look on my face. And I look at him, and he says, the poor need education. I still remember his gesture. They need education in how to be human beings. And I go, boom. The capacity for selective perception in regard to class, race, and gender realities is limitless. Reality is a secondary consideration or no consideration at all. Reality can be stood on its head. That seems to be a manifestation of human nature, or a certain kind, anyway, of certain people in certain social situations.
The wealth doesn't trickle down. It is siphoned up from the labor of the many into the pockets of the few. I don't like great concentrations of private wealth because it causes public poverty. Corporate wealth is the greatest single cause of poverty. It is theft, and it makes a mockery of democracy. In fact, in every society where you have wealth, you have poverty. That's how you get wealth, by creating poverty. That's how you get... That's how... That's how